Our guest tonight is Rick Swartz, a lawyer with over 25 years in politics and activism dealing with immigration rights. We'll be right back. We have a couple of messages, and we'll be back in just a moment. Thank you, Kevin. And welcome back to The People Speak. Over the last quarter of a century, Rick Swartz may have done more than any other activist to encourage a healthy level of immigration in America and to protect the rights of immigrants once they are here. After graduating from University of Chicago Law School, Rick Swartz directed an immigration rights project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights before going on to found in 1982 what has become the nation's leading immigration rights advocacy group, the National Immigration Forum. Rick was president of the forum, a coalition of more than 250 national organizations and several thousand local groups until 1990. In that post, he worked to secure rights for Haitian and Central American war refugees, to legalize the status of millions of other immigrants, and to battle the anti-immigrant and English-only movements. Since leaving the forum, Mr. Swartz, now 52, has run a small public policy firm representing a range of corporate and nonprofit clients and at the same time continuing his immigration advocacy work. Welcome to The People Speak, Mr. Swartz. And as you can attest, when the people speak, we make a difference. Rick, would you please come to the mic and tell us about your involvement with the immigration rights and why you feel it is so important to protect the rights of immigrants in the United States?
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to join you tonight, and a hearty welcome to your listeners. Thank you. Immigration, the movements of people across national borders is a deep and profound and ancient part of the human experience. And it is quintessentially part of the American experience for reasons I don't think I need to elaborate or describe in great detail. So there's a calling to understand that the movements of people seeking to better their lives, to find freedom, to create better opportunities for their progeny. It's a fundamentally human and a quintessentially American phenomenon. So that's the call of it, I think. How societies throughout human history deal with, accept, or reject, or persecute the stranger is a mark of a society or a nation's character. And in that regard, as America, day by day, year by year, generation by generation, seeks to live up to her promise and the experience of Americans who have come before us, the immigration story is central. And I would say perhaps closing for the moment, that in a world of instant communication, a global economy, the internet and television and hundreds of millions of transactions a day across national borders, how human beings treat each other face to face and through the laws and conduct of our countries will have a great effect on the future in this time of great uncertainty. So that's how I might tonight sum up the spirit of it all.
You know, I happen to be an immigrant myself originally to this country, Rick, so I have a fond respect for your work here. There's a House resolution, Rick, Resolution 4437. Can you tell us and explain to our audience here what this means for immigrants in the United States, how this resolution affects them?
I'll do my best. This is a piece of legislation that was adopted in December of 2005 by the House of Representatives. Approximately 210 Republicans voted for it. 17 or so Republicans voted against it, including, of considerable note, John Boehner, the new majority leader who replaced Tom DeLay, voted against this the House bill. And most Democrats voted against it, and a handful, more than a handful, 35% of Democrats voted for it. It's known as the Sensenbrenner bill. It's been a focus of attention since December, and a rallying cry, as you and your listeners know, for the communities across the country, immigrant communities and Americans and churches and labor unions and employers and others who say, you know, this is not the path to a better future for America, what the House of Representatives did in December. The specifics are many. The consequences of this law being enacted and enforced would be dramatic. I'll give you some examples. Those that have garnered significant press attention include all undocumented immigrants in the United States, whatever that number may be, 8, 10, 11 million, regardless of their age or the their character, would be deemed by act of Congress felons, and thereby not simply strangers within our midst, but fugitives within our midst, 12 million people or 10 million people at one fell swoop, and with extraordinary effects on their lives, but also all the people around and about them, whether they're employers, their neighbors, their fellow parishioners, great consequence to being around and about, living with, working with, assisting, providing humanitarian care to these people who, by act of Congress under this law, became felons. Now, that has garnered quite a bit of controversy. It led Cardinal Mahoney of Los Angeles to declare, and my guess is that the Pope himself had a hand in this, that priests of the Catholic Church would not abide by such a law. It would be unjust. There are many other provisions in this law. That one, I think, is probably not going to become law because it's become so controversial. It's been rejected in the Senate already as the Senate is considering immigration legislation now pending. In a variety of other ways, it would make retroactive changes in our law, so persons could be punished tomorrow for activity that was not of immigration consequence 20 or 30 years ago. Beyond immigration, the concept of retroactive application of laws leading to criminal or, in these cases, deportable offenses tomorrow, that's a significant approach to American jurisprudence. So that's become a major controversy, and it's led to major protests and a very focused, important national debate.
Well, thank you, Rick. You know, it's interesting to see that, you know, when we look at the immigration problems here in the United States, for the illegal immigrants, it's about finding work. That's what it really boils down to, finding work, feeding and clothing and sheltering their families. Yet for the employers, it's about profit. With undocumented workers and the ability for our business owners to make a greater profit due to this cheap labor, how can one really balance that out? How can we keep the integrity and the security and the safety of the immigrant community here in the United States, and at the same time not affect the work community here in the United States? It just seems to me that that's just a losing battle when you think about this.
M-
my response would be to render what is legitimate human striving, that is the immigrants seeking, as you just stated, to better their lives, to provide for their families, and in recognition of the need of our national economy and labor market to render what is of mutual benefit legal. Our laws of the last 25, 30 years, in significant respects when it comes to immigration, have not been pragmatic, wise, or realistic with regard to what is fundamentally a win-win phenomena. By driving it underground, by not allowing employers to legally hire or workers to legally work in a variety of our industries, despite the needs, we compound the contradictions and the woe that is now the phenomena of 8 or 10 or 12 million people living and working in the country illegally. And that's the debate that the country's having in the Congress. Looking to the future quickly, the fundamental question is, if it's good for the people of the United States and the country as a whole for immigration to continue to be a dramatic engine of our creativity, our love for freedom, our aspiration for a better future, that energy from people who have had the guts to vote with their feet, that's been at the heart of the American genius, it seems to me. But it has to be recognized in our laws for it to be nutritious in our society. So that's how I would respond to your question about the and when immigrants are legal, they're and becoming Americans, they're much less susceptible to the exploiter, those who would cheat and steal, and to the lure of a criminal life. So legal is good.
Legal is very good, and which brings me to, why would our government look the other way, allowing employers to replace American workers with undocumented workers? It seems to me that on one hand they're complaining that we have illegal immigrants, and at the other hand, they're encouraging illegal immigration. In 1999, President Bill Clinton collected over almost $4 million in fines from 890 companies, and President Bush, in the year 2004, levied absolutely no fines against U.S. companies. So I wonder, and I ask you, do they want illegal, undocumented immigrants in this country, or don't they? Or is this just another bureaucratic game that they keep playing with these, with the cost of the immigrants in this country, a horrific cost?
Let me ask you two clarifying questions to your question. Who's the they, and why don't you sketch the character of the costs, the horrific costs that I take it you believe the immigration, that immigrants impose. Then I'll try to, I'll be able to respond, I think, more precisely.
Let me ask you, Rick, how does racism play into this immigration card? And is that an issue that you have worked with? My question to you was about bigotry and racism here in this country. How we can fight against kind of bigotry, and how you have worked with the system to help the burden of bigotry in this country.
Well, I think racism and bigotry is best addressed by in institutions and in neighborhoods. As human beings have more and more interaction with one another, pulling data on immigration over a number of decades now indicates that Americans often love and respect the immigrants that they know personally, those they work with, those who are the friends of their children or the parents of their children's friends, those with whom they attend services. So it's a day in and day out reality of American gathering places, as soft as that may sound, which is, I think, the best way to address fear and bigotry and prejudice. At other times, we bring lawsuits, we protest in the street, we point out unfairness and injustice, and remind Americans of all creeds and colors and ethnicities and origins that we're in this together. And a fundamental way to deal, in my experience, with bigotry and racism is help those who are afraid of the stranger understand how their lives are made better by the presence of the stranger. So it's in that spirit, but fundamentally it's a neighborhood-to-neighborhood challenge.
Why are you so invested in this, Rick? Why have you spent your life doing this work?
Well, thank you for that question. I believe that America, my country, has been, is, and will become a better, stronger, more creative and human society through the continuing experience of immigration. I believe that's more important today than ever because of the realities of globalization. I believe that there's a human race and a human civilization that is in the daily lives of billions around the world now apparent. And that wasn't true in terms of instant communication and television and billions of phone calls. Even 50 years ago, it was beginning. And that accordingly, how the human race governs and manages and addresses and succeeds with the phenomena of international migration is a, will have a lot to do with how the human race moves forward on all sorts of fundamentally political challenges, whether that's the environment, or terrorism, or the global economy, or issues of race and inequity, and religious and civil strife in other parts of the globe. So I'm a lucky American as I look at it. I've had an understanding and an opportunity, and I was been able to act upon it.
A report in the Christian Science Monitor blames the expert. It says blames the experts for the twin pressures of ethnic advocacy and business interests. And later in another article, it translated ethnic advocacy to mean favors, buying favors and votes within the illegal immigrant community. If an immigrant doesn't have a vote, he or she has relatives who do. And many people believe that President Bush's administration's lack of immigration enforcement in 2004 was directly connected with the Republican Party's goal to court the Hispanic vote. Do you agree that that was a great influence in electing President George W. Bush?
Well, that's like a four-part question, but if I understood it, there is virtually nothing in reality about illegal aliens voting or being paid to vote or buying their vote. There may be isolated cases of corruption or bad practices here and there, but as a national phenomena, there's absolutely nothing to it. In terms of how or why Bush was elected, I think it has nothing to do with the any kind of phenomenon of immigrants voting because it's rare and isolated. is the Republican Party and George Bush reaching out to new ethnic communities, new Americans from all around the world? Sure, and so are the Democrats, because the again, throughout American history, the immigrants of today become voters of tomorrow. But there's also a recognition that, as we've discussed before, that American vitality is enhanced by the immigration phenomenon. What we have to do is right, smart, and legally. So I'm not cynical, ultimately, about the politics of immigration. What I try to recognize is that political parties and elected officials make decisions for a variety of reasons, including, often first and foremost, impacts on election. But that's the way it is. And for a guy who does work around ideas and issues, I try to take that into account, but I'm not part of it.
Well, thank you, Rick. We're going to have to take a break right now, folks. We'll be back after a short break.
Your research paper is due tomorrow. You have no idea what to bring to tonight's dinner party, and you could really use some help in deciding about that new car you're thinking of buying. Where do you turn? How about the library? The library is your one stop for everything you're looking for, in print and online. Find what you need at your library.
Are you appalled that our country is spending billions on war while cutting funds for our libraries, hospitals, and schools? Are you heartsick at the suffering of the Iraqi people? Then join me, Medea Benjamin, in signing Code Pink's urgent call for peace in Iraq. Sign on today at www.womensaynotowar.org.
Thanks, Kevin, and welcome back with Rick Swartz. Rick is an immigration lawyer that has dedicated a good part of his life to the rights of immigrants in this country. We're going to be taking some audience questions now. We'll be asking you to come to the microphone, state your name, where you're talking from, and a brief question to Rick, and then Rick will take the microphone after the question has been asked. Please come to the mic, next speaker.
There we go. Thank you. First of all, Mr. Swartz, mucho gusto, and thank you for taking your time to come speak to us. My name's Steve. I'm from Santa Fe, New Mexico. I was born and raised in Hereford, Arizona, a stone's throw away from the border. And I, like you, find this to be a very, very important issue. What I have a problem with in the new law, more than anything, I think, is by the fact that they made them a felon, made coming into the United States illegally a felony. That makes the people that's trying to help these poor people felons also. Within this new law, there's laws that would make giving the illegal aliens succor and you know, food and water and all of that to be illegal. We've successfully pushed the immigration, the illegal immigration, into some of the most horrible deserts in our southern border that we've ever seen. Most people don't realize, I don't think, that you're not worth much after about 4 hours without water in these deserts. And to set up stations is now illegal, if I'm not mistaken. It's a big issue here in New Mexico, of course, New Mexico being a state of a majority of Mexican Americans. I myself am one. But how is it that we the people, I guess, can make a change in this, because this is bad. This is like we're pushing. We're in the tunes of hundreds of people, men, women, and children, dying of thirst, dying of hunger in these deserts, even with the help that we have. And now this administration under George W. Bush wants it to make it illegal to offer help to people. because, of course, that ends up becoming aiding and abetting, I believe, is how they're going to figure it. But please tell us some of that. Mic's open.
Well, thank you, Steve, and Mucho gusto. The question you ask is focused in on what has become a headline issue in this immigration debate. And in terms of the legislative process, I think, frankly, that the perspective and the voice that you represent has been heard in Washington and in the Republican Party as well as the Democratic Party, and that, as I mentioned earlier, the call of the Cardinal of Los Angeles on this point, I think, has been powerfully heard. So it's an example where the voices of individuals and the voices of the leadership institutions can have a quick and immediate impact. So on this particular point, progress is being made. Much of the rest of the proposal being debated, however, leave much to be desired.
Yes, it's my mic. Rick, thank you for meeting with us. It's an honor, really, to give up your time to be with us, and we appreciate it. You can rest assured of that. Rick, the impression I'm getting from the problem of immigration is this, and this is only my personal opinion now, and I will be extremely blunt. I always am, as the people in here who know me know that I usually am. It seems to me as though we have a nationalistic ideology against immigrants. We have an attempt to divert what is happening in the Middle East. I think we have the issue of racism going on here. And thirdly, how is NAFTA affecting these issues? I'm talking about the big corporations in the United States that have camped out in Mexico. How are they affecting this issue? Thank you very much. Welcome for your comments. Go ahead, Rick.
Well, the challenge is to do something about all this. We can characterize and condemn and often with truth describe what is happening in America with regard to immigration in the words that you use. But that doesn't in and of itself advance the progress of the lives of immigrants or the building of a broader sense of community and acceptance in American neighborhoods. So that's my first response. With regard to NAFTA and related dynamics, I've worked extensively on NAFTA more than a decade ago in different respects. I'll give you one example, however. There's no doubt in my mind that NAFTA, and in particular the power, economic force, power of crop subsidies, in this case, with regard to Mexico, corn subsidies, American taxpayer dollars, being spent in the billions to subsidize the production of a select few row crops, has contributed to illegal migration from Mexico. Evidence indicates that over a million Mexican farmers from a decade ago no longer have been able to survive on the land of Mexico because of the combination of NAFTA, Mexican government policies, and U.S. corn subsidies. They've left the land, and they're now the illegal immigrant farmhands in America's fields. So the important understanding here is how a range of forces combine to both push people out of Mexico and other sending countries and pull them in
to meet the low-wage labor market needs of the American economy. A more holistic understanding will help the country make smarter judgments when it comes to law, policy, and how we treat one another.
Thank you, Rick. Our next question will come from Peace Lover. Peace Lover, will you step to the mic, please, and tell us your first name and where you're calling from?
Yeah, hi, Rick. This is Mike, California. Rick, you know, I did a lot of research on this, and your name turned up prominently when it came to the rights of immigrants, the organizations that you've started or been associated with. And I'd like to ask you, since you've been at it so long, regarding what's happened over the last 4 or 5 years with the Bush administration, it seemed like after 9/11 happened, there was a great deal of paranoia, real or fostered, by the Bush administration that the terrorists were coming. I look at what's going on now, the fear that they're instilling in the American people that immigrants are going to steal their jobs, as another attempt to blame somebody else for their own shortcomings. I look at this immigration bill as that attempt. And the people associated with this bill, like Sensenbrenner, Tancredo, Canton, and the FAIR organizations, they have their roots in white supremacy, or what I would call more than nationalism. It's kind of like they cater to the rich, the corporate, one segment of the population in America. What's your feelings on this? Do you believe that there is a racial or a racist source behind all of this? Because that's the way I see it when I look at who is really behind 4437. Is that the way it is, always has historically been? Thank you.
Well, thank you for the question. Immigration policy and politics and political culture surrounding the stranger, not just in American history, but in other countries going back millennia, often there is a racial undercurrent or cultural fear of the other that provides fertile ground for the demagogues, for those who would use fear and disdain or hatred for the other to drive public passion. Frankly, in this respect, I think the Republican Party is quite schizophrenic and, or perhaps multipolar. I don't attribute, frankly, to the Bush administration per se that kind of animus, but many others, from Tancredo now the leading example, Pat Buchanan in his heyday, have used fear of the stranger to bring out the worst in Americans, particularly working class Americans or poor Americans or disadvantaged Americans, who have some reason to be trepidatious about an uncertain future in a global, rapidly changing world. Now, the FAIR and John Tanton that you referred to, as you know, it's been a matter of my concern going back 25 years or more about America cannot take for granted the danger of creeping fascism. The institution of slavery, the abominable stain on our history, the legacies that persist, the Ku Klux Klan emerging in the 1830s, the Know Nothing Party in the 1840s and 50s that Lincoln disdained and warned against, similar movements after the First World War, anti-immigrant movements being rooted in
fascist or totalitarian tendencies that any and all societies are in danger of. Benjamin Franklin said, it's a republic if you can keep it. And Barry Goldwater said, in defense of liberty, spare no effort. So I do believe that the immigration issue has been organized around in America as, and in Europe in the last several decades by forces rooted in a eugenic population control ideology that are spending $25 or $30 or $40 million a year to stir the fear of the stranger within the American body politic. I think it's dangerous. I think it's coming to a head now, and I think it needs to be well understood that the American people are better than that. And at the end of the day, I'm confident they'll not succumb.
Thank you, Rick. Our next question will come from Pepsi Man. Pepsi Man, can you come to the mic and tell us who you are and where you're calling from?
That individual is answering the door. My name is Mike. I'm from California again. And I have a follow-up question, Rick. From what I've studied about the immigration problem, I think that people have to know what's going on. I think the American people have to know what's going on. If Americans knew that 50% of the food they eat comes from Mexico, if they knew of the sweatshops in Mexico run by American corporations, if they knew that people in Mexico are growing food for the United States while they go hungry and are forced to come to the United States for work, and are again victimized by corporations who take advantage of them, I think the American people would wake up. I think they would understand what the real situation is. I would love to have Rick Swartz on national TV on something like Nightline, telling everybody what it's really like with pictures and videos of what. There's a train line that kids who have lost their mothers and fathers who have come here to the United States to immigrate. They take the chance, they risk their life riding on the tops of these trains. I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of miles it is, but it goes all the way from South America up to the United States. And many of them fall victim to gangs or accidents or something like that. If Americans knew the true story of what we're doing to our neighbors to the south of the border, I think they would really, really open up their hearts and have a better understanding of exactly what is going on. The immigrants are victimized on both sides of the border. I think Americans have to realize that. Rick, my question to you is, what can we do to help make this known? How can we promote or help your efforts? Thank you so much.
Without doubt, in my experience, it's for immigrants and refugees and migrants themselves to find their voice in America, tell their own stories, be visible, and many need help to achieve that, and they have, throughout my 30 years involved in these matters, through churches, through unions, through enlightened business leaders, it's the immigrant voice itself that is the most profound and powerful for the American public, and I learned that in my late 20s as a lawyer, activist, organizer for Haitian refugees. And I'll just tell you a quick story from then. I'll tell you two stories from then. Jocelyn Marcellus was an 18-year-old Haitian who I met in Miami. He had been in prison for 2 years in the most barbaric conditions imaginable in Haiti. He was released as arbitrarily as he was imprisoned, in hiding in Haiti for months, fled to the United States at age 18. He was a witness in a federal class action lawsuit on behalf of the rights of Haitian asylum seekers on the stand in federal court for almost a full day, a poet in his telling of the truth of the conditions in Haiti, what had happened to him, and the conditions of his flight and arrival in the United States. His story was told accordingly in the New York Times. Another group of patients, almost all of whom were functionally illiterate, came by bus from Miami, about 40 of them, to lobby in Washington. They had their leaders. And among other activities over 4 days, we had these young men and women in Creole at the top floor of the State Department telling their story directly to the Secretary of State for Human Rights, to the head of the Refugee Bureau, to the head of the Latin American Bureau. I was simply a helping hand. It was the power of their presence and their own stories that literally played a decisive role in the Carter administration changing its treatment of Haitian refugees. That was 9 to 30 years ago. If it could happen then, of consequence, it could happen tomorrow, of consequence. So that's my response.
Thank you. We're going to take one more question from Walks the Desert, Steve, before we take a break. Go ahead, Walks. The mic is yours.
It's me again there, Mr. Swartz, and thank you for, again, taking our questions. You know, as I said, I grew up right on the border, and the illegal aliens were kind of part of the scenario of my growing up. You know, and I find it amazing that this is an argument anymore. We need them. I think anybody that takes time looking into the illegal immigrants realizes this fact. They're more than happy to work for wages that we would consider slave wages, which I think is a whole nother argument. But yet, now all of a sudden they have become the enemy in this zeal for this administration to find something that the American people are going to get behind. They've turned around and made an enemy of probably some of the most moral, some of the most people with the greatest integrity that we could find. You know, their work ethics, the United States lost, 100 years ago? And they're more than willing to produce our foods, to produce our fruits, or one of my favorites, of course, is the salsa. But I'm wondering. It always comes down to this integral to me is what can I do about it? You know, I'm doing everything I can. And yet it doesn't seem to be working under this administration, that the voice of the people no longer is heard by this administration. So I'm getting called to dinner. Thank you again there, Mr. Swartz, for taking our questions and talking to us. It's your mic.
Well, my pleasure, and everybody can do more than they think they can do if they have the heart, the will, and the determination to take political action. And so whether it's this issue or many others, it's small acts by many is the way to create new power to move society and the government in a better direction. So as abstract as that sounds, I believe this immigration issue is a challenge and a test to that simple possibility. And we've had errors like this before in America. And the immigrants who were scorned 100 years ago, their grandchildren and great-grandchildren are the successful leaders of our society today. And as challenging as the current debate is and atmosphere is, anybody can take small steps and make a big difference. Thank you all for having me tonight. I've enjoyed it.
Our next question will come from Carmen. We have two more questions, if we can keep them brief. And then we'll go into our break. Carmen, can you please come to the mic and tell us where you're calling from and your first name, please? Someone please undot Carmen.
Okay, great. Thanks, Mr. Schwartz, for being here. I have a quick comment, and then I'll ask my question. I'm not at all threatened by migrant workers and domestic workers that come across the border, and I find it ludicrous that people are so unfocused on that when we have a real threat to our jobs by this guest worker program. I'm a nurse in Austin, Texas. Oh, did I say that? My name is Carmen. I'm from Austin. I'm sorry. right now, the past few months, the nurses that are now graduating and coming into the workforce are being offered a lot less money than they had years ago. I'll give you one. For instance, there was this girl that was working as a unit clerk at one of the hospitals, making like $13 an hour. And as she, when she graduated as an LVN, she got offered $10 an hour. Of course, she said no and went to work at a nursing home. And then, of course, they filled that job with an Indian traveling nurse from India. So we have that problem. And right now, you can walk into any one of the hospitals on the 3 to 11, 11 to 7 shift, and you'll be the only American there sometimes, you know. So my question to you is this. What is the percentage of Mexican illegal aliens or those from south of the border that people are so focused on today? Of the illegal alien population, do they comprise most of them? I don't believe so because I see so many others. Thank you.
Mexican among the illegal or undocumented population is generally estimated, but these are all estimates, that people from Latin America are perhaps 70%, give or take, of the total population, or 6 or 7 million out of 10 million, and that of that percentage from south of the border, as you put it, the significant majority are from Mexico, but not all. It's also, I think, generally understood and agreed as a factual matter that the vast, vast, vast majority of these people are living lives free of crime, or, as a show began, are taking care of their families, are working hard and assiduously, and very often take farm workers as a primary example, or people who lay asphalt or tar roofs, taking jobs that it's hard to find Americans who want to do that kind of work because that's work with no future. But for immigrants from Mexico, it often is a step up. But those are the rough percentages as a matter of nationality. Hardworking, though, almost all are.
There's your land. This land is mine. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest. The Gulf Stream waters, this land.